Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does a neo-radical need in order to be effective? Deep commitment to a particular issue is a given, of course, but stellar communication skills can be learned and improved, if necessary, making radicalism more powerful and more effective. And my guest has just published some useful guidelines. Jason Delgandio is an assistant professor at Temple University and a political and social activist. His new book is called Rhetoric for Radicals, a Handbook for 21st Century Activists. Jason, welcome to Think.
How are you doing? How are you doing today?
Great, thank you. I love this line that you wrote. You believe that activism is not so much about changing the world as about creating it. Can you explain that?
Yes, well, I come from a theoretical background that says that human beings are full-time communicators, and basically we are rhetorical beings through and through. And through our communication and through our rhetoric, we actually create our shared social world. So, yes, as activists, as organizers, you know, technically, yes, we're trying to change the world. But if you stop and think about what I said earlier about how we as communicative beings are actually creating the world, it's really about creating the world as opposed to just simply changing the world.
Yeah, you write that all human reality is rhetorically constructed.
Yes, yes.
So is radical rhetoric really all that different from general purpose rhetoric?
Well, I think the intent is different, right? So, for instance, one of the things I do argue in the book is that we are all rhetorical beings and that we're engaged in communication all the time. From the time we were born, from the time that we pass away, we're always communicating all the time. But now as an activist, as an organizer, as a radical, what you want to do is sit down and really think about your communication, think about how you are communicating with people, how they are affected by that communication, and then use that knowledge and use those skills to your advantage. In other words, literally use your communication in order to create a different reality or an alternative reality that we can then embody and carry out.
Let's talk about that word radical. How do you define that? Because a lot of people might believe very passionately about certain things, but they wouldn't think of themselves, they wouldn't apply the label radical to themselves.
Yes. Well, traditionally speaking, radicalism is about going to the root cause or the root causes of a social or political issue. In other words, you want to find out really what is the root cause here, then challenge that cause, and then try to create a different type of root that will change that problem. So it's not about putting a Band-Aid over the wound, but rather really fixing the wound and getting it right. That way you can move beyond that problem.
So how do you define rhetoric as used by radicals? Obviously, it's attached to the purpose of the argument, but can you talk about what really makes it separate?
Right. Well, one of the things, at the most basic level, one of the ways I explain it in the book is that, you know, rhetoric has many negative connotations over the years, right? I try to dispel many of those myths and try to say, look, you know, rhetoric is simply about sitting down and constantly trying to improve your communication in order to achieve your social and political goals. And so if you really want to become a better activist, you know, try to change the world or bring about better conditions, then sit down and really work on your communication skills. And as you do that, you improve your chances, improve your ability to create profound social change.
And this ability to persuade or inform or motivate goes beyond just words. Even silence can be a form of rhetoric.
Oh, no doubt about that. Yes, yes. I mean, think about how we use silence to communicate on a regular basis. So phrases like you give someone the cold shoulder, right? Well, what does that mean? It means you are actually using your silence to communicate a certain kind of message to people, right? So even when you're not actually saying something, you're still communicating. And in fact, that's referred to as nonverbal communication. So when we say verbal communication, that's talking about words and language. So right now I'm speaking with you, and that's a verbal communication. But at the same time, though, there's nonverbal communication. So my hand gestures, my head nods, my eye contact, the way I move, the way I walk, even the sound of my voice, not necessarily what I'm saying, but how I say it is nonverbal communication. That's all part of the rhetorical apparatus.
Jason Delgandio is my guest. He is an activist and also an assistant professor at Temple University. His new book is called Rhetoric for Radicals, a Handbook for 21st Century Activists. And things like personal consumption are part of this sort of silent rhetoric as well.
Yeah, so in the book I refer to that as body rhetoric or as embodied argumentation. In other words, what do we do with our bodies? What do we do with our daily activities, our lifestyles, in order to bring about a better social world, right? So personal consumption. Obviously nowadays, issues of global warming, climate change, consumption, oil, gasoline, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those are all on the table in terms of political topics, right? Well, now we can think about those in terms of, or we can think about those issues in terms of rhetoric and communication. In other words, how do you live your life on a daily basis? Do you recycle, right? Do you use plastic? Do you use your car or do you use your bicycle to go to work? So on and so on and so on. And each one of those choices you make in your personal daily life is actually a rhetorical message that's being sent out into the world that is thus affecting other people's minds, other people's perceptions, and also the physical conditions that we're living in.
Jason, how important is confrontation?
Well, confrontation, okay, that's a good question. Let me back up a second. Many people perceive, quote-unquote, radicals as being very confrontational. And there's good reason for that, right? Protests, marches, direct actions, nonviolent civil disobedience, so on and so on and so on. But there are different ways to be confrontational. You can confront someone. In other words, you can confront an institution, a power structure, a political representative, a corporation, whatever the case may be. But as you confront them, that does not necessarily mean you have to take militant action. Doesn't necessarily mean you have to yell, scream, or be angry. You're simply confronting the situation and trying to come up with rhetorical tactics to challenge and overturn certain problems, certain issues.
Mm-hmm. So confrontation doesn't necessarily mean conflict.
Correct. That's true.
Mm-hmm. One thing that really comes across here reading the book is that while events and things like demonstrations might appear spontaneous to those who come upon them, clearly the best ones are meticulously planned. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that, starting with the need to know your audience. How do radicals figure out who they need to address?
Well, I would say one of the critiques I actually make in my book is that perhaps we're not always doing our rhetorical homework. In other words, perhaps when we organize our protests, organize our demonstrations, we're not focused enough on our audience, right? So if you say, well, I want to organize a protest, and you say, well, who it's for? It's all American people, all Americans. Okay, to a certain degree, I understand what you're saying, but think about how broad that is. Now, if you can answer the question, okay, who specifically are you trying to address? Now, you can actually create a demonstration or protest that addresses specific people, and therefore you can create certain kinds of slogans and invite certain kinds of speakers that address that target audience, right? So in terms of audience, that is a basic rhetorical necessity that you have to think about regardless of what you are doing. Now, in terms of demonstrations, think about who you are demonstrating for and the reasons why. And as you work on that, as you figure that out, now construct your demonstration to target that very specific audience. And if you do that, then your demonstration will be more powerful and probably generate more attention and garner more support.
Well, I guess there are different goals with demonstrations. Some of them clearly are designed to sort of embarrass certain parties into action. Others are designed to get people to agree with the people who are demonstrating. So how would you go about sort of appealing to either of those needs?
Well, if you're trying to embarrass a certain politician, right, then usually with that, it's best to use political humor, right? Get your costumes out, think about funny slogans, be more interactive. In other words, as you're marching down the street, try to get people who are watching more interactive. In other words, approach them in a non-confrontational way, but being inviting, and get them to laugh at what you are doing. Right, because if you're trying to embarrass someone, that's usually the best way. Because if you're too mean and nasty about it, people actually don't like that.
Regardless of whether or not they agree with what you're trying
to say. Yes, they can agree with the message, but if you're mean and nasty about it, it actually turns people off, anyway.
That's interesting. That seems to be one of the lessons that PETA has learned over the years. Mm-hmm. They are a little bit less confrontational now and a little bit more likely to try and appeal to people with humor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, humor is a huge, huge political tactic. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's a basic human emotion. And if you can tap into that human emotion, who doesn't like to laugh? Now, I don't think we should use politics simply to satire or irony or humor, right? But as one form of rhetoric, I think it's a very powerful form, and it should be used.
So on the other hand, if you really want to motivate people to align with your cause and to then be willing to also take action, humor might be one tool, but maybe not the best one to get people on board.
Well, a lot of times, a lot of activists will actually then turn to more anger, right? In other words, if you're trying to get your audience enraged at the conditions, therefore they'll stand up and fight for their rights. And although I think that is appropriate at times, I think a more powerful approach is usually basic storytelling. In other words, when we think of rhetoric, we often think of argumentation and logic, and that's fine. That should be used at times. But storytelling really taps into a different part of the human experience, right? When you tell stories, it speaks to people's minds, imaginations, desires, right? And those things really break open our world, right? Our emotional worlds, our private thoughts. And if you can speak to that part of the human experience, that's more likely to mobilize people to take action.
Do you think it's important for radicals to be transparent at the outset about their intention in telling a story, or is it okay to sort of get the attention of a particular audience with a story and let the moral of that reveal itself at the end?
Well, I think either one is fine, right? I think either one is fine, as long as you as the rhetorician, as long as you as the activist or the radical really understand what you are doing, right? Now, at the same time, though, I don't want to be confused here with being deceitful, right? So when we tell stories, I'm someone who takes a strong stance against deceit. I believe that there's a certain kind of ethics that goes along with your political rhetoric, right? And if you're deceitful, if you are not being fully honest or transparent, then that could be perceived in very negative ways. And I don't blame people if they perceive it in a negative way, right? I think that's what they should do. But again, though, you know, there's different ways. In other words, you can reveal your point at the very beginning, right, and allow people to ride along with your story. Or you can tell a story where at the beginning you're not really sure, the audience isn't really sure what you're getting at, but by the end they get the point. And then when they walk away, they go, aha, I got it. I understand what he or she is saying.
One other thing that becomes apparent when you look at really defining the audience and making sure that you're speaking directly to them is that a larger audience of human beings isn't necessarily the most effective one for rhetoric.
Oh, what do you mean by that? I'm not entirely sure.
Well, you don't necessarily have to get to 10,000 people if you get to the proper 15 or 20 or whatever.
Oh, yes. It's not always about numbers. Mm-hmm. Sure, we, you know, as an activist, we all want big numbers. We want as large of a crowd as possible, and that's almost always a goal. But sometimes it is more important to get that one-on-one connection, whether it literally is one-on-one or a small room full of people or maybe a few hundred people. Right? But if you can get that human connection, that that person-to-person connection, you know, even if it's a small group of people, that can be more powerful. In other words, those people now walk away and then mobilize more people, mobilize their own communities, as opposed to getting 100,000 people where everything's very distant, very abstract, and there's no personal connection there. If that's the case, it's actually, I want to say, it's poor rhetoric.
What do you have to take into account with regard to not only the political climate, but the physical setting in which one of these interactions takes place, the time of the event, the duration of a rhetorical encounter?
No, that's all a big part of it. So, for instance, if you're giving a speech, it is very different to give a speech to a small room, let's say a classroom, of 20 people, right, as opposed to a large auditorium that sits 500 people, right? The overall physical environment definitely affects our cognitive as well as emotional perception of that speech, right? And you, as the speaker, want to be aware of those different conditions and adapt your body, your nonverbal communication, as well as what you say to those conditions, right? And the same thing can be said if you're giving a speech indoors as well as outdoors, right? All of those minor factors that seem so insignificant are actually very significant. And if you want to be the best rhetorician you can be, or be the best activist you can be, you always consider every minute detail and try to accommodate for those details to the best of your ability.
And I guess you also have to anticipate people who might counter-protest or have demonstrations that have a very different conclusion.
Oh, yeah, I've been to many, many protests where I was on one side and there was counter-protests. And I personally think that's a great form of democracy. When you see that, sure, I don't agree with your message. I don't agree with the fact you're disagreeing with me, right? But I do appreciate the fact that you are willing to stand up for what you believe in and that you are publicly displaying your own messages. Now, again, if you're giving a speech, though, and that's to occur, there are many different ways to approach that. It really comes down to what you are, as a speaker, comfortable with doing, right? So, for instance, some people, when they get hecklers, will joke back with them, right? And that could work well. Other speakers will ignore them and pretend as if they're not there. Other people get angry and start yelling at them, right? Now, I'm not going to sit here and say, you know, which one of those tactics is best, because I think it has a lot to do with your own personality and how you can best communicate your ideas with those counter-protesters.
And I suppose you also have to decide whether or not there are people in the group that are particularly good at filling one of those roles or another.
Yeah, so if we're talking about an organization or a community group, you know, you have multiple people inside your organization. And if you're really thinking about your communication, then think about which person can do what task and skill within that group. In other words, if you have a good speaker, that person should give the speeches. If you have a good writer, that person should create the flyers, so on and so on and so on.
Jason Delgandio is my guest. He is an activist himself and an assistant professor at Temple University. His new book is called Rhetoric for Radicals, a Handbook for 21st Century Activists. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is activist and Temple University Assistant Professor Jason Delgandio. His new book is called Rhetoric for Radicals, a Handbook for 21st Century Activists. I wonder if you can define this term for us that you use in the book, neo-radicalism.
Yeah, so what I'm doing with that term is trying to redefine or re-specify this idea and this practice of radicalism, right? So neo means new, so it's a new form of radicalism. What I argue in the book, and that's, you know, obviously part of the whole idea of the book, is that 21st century activists really need to sit down and start using their communication and rhetoric to their advantage. So a neo-radical really takes the idea of communication and rhetoric seriously. And rather than simply trying to change the world, like we said earlier, what we're trying to do is actually create different realities. In other words, to communicate alternative realities into existence. Now, when I say communicate, it could be, you know, your language, it could be your nonverbal communication, what you do with your daily lifestyle, so on and so on and so on, but basically using all of your different communicative devices to literally invoke and to create different realities.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Bernie in Frisco. Hello, Bernie.
Hi, good afternoon. I would like to comment on the use of the word radical. I'm about to go into an office building and meet with a lady who's an officer in the building, an officer in the corporation, has worked herself up, gone to college, become an officer, is highly regarded and very intelligent. And yet when I ask her what she thinks about somebody like Michelle Obama, she says, well, she's a radical. This woman that I'm going to visit, this intelligent and wonderful woman, is the definition of a radical in this area. She has changed her lifestyle to become basically an executive, and that's considered radical, too radical in this area, even for people who've done it. Radical seems to be a, if not a dirty word, then a dirty concept in this area. And, you know, I'll take my comments off the air or I'll stay here. You decide.
Thanks for your call, Bernie. What do you think about the term, Jason? Does it scare people off in all parts of the country, or is it just here in Texas?
I would say that, generally speaking, the word radical does have negative connotations, right? And it, a lot of times it does scare people off. So a lot of times when I first meet people, I don't say, oh, I'm a radical. Right? That's not what I say. Instead, what I try to do is explain my worldview, explain my political ideas in a way that they can understand them, in a way that invites them into my worldview as opposed to alienate them. Now, in terms of the word radical itself, though, I do want to admit that it's a relational term. In other words, all words are relative to certain people's experience and how they understand those words, right? And so what one person considers radical, another person can consider conservative or liberal and so on and so on and so on. So the word itself is relational. There's no doubt about that.
So let's talk about, we got into this a little bit before the break, the idea that people will be counter-protesting at times. How useful is it when both sides, if there are two sides sort of demonstrating with equal vigor on different sides of an issue, how useful is it for them to just both keep continuing? And how much, to what extent is listening part of this sort of rhetoric?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it depends on what the goals are of each group. If you simply want to get out there and to display your emotions, in particular, let's say anger, then I think that's fine. Now, if you really, though, want to get somewhere, in other words, you want to, you know, change certain power structures, change certain aspects of our political system or our society, then perhaps those two opposing groups should attempt to sit down and communicate with each other, in other words, speak to each other. I'm not saying you will agree on everything. Probably you'll agree on very little. But to sit down and actually kind of figure out, okay, how do you see the world? How do I see the world? Now, is there any common ground that we share with each other? And if so, can we work on that common ground to actually both start walking towards our own visions of a better world, right? And like you said, though, that does involve listening. In other words, you have to listen to the opposing side. And actually listening is important for a few different reasons. One, in the scenario that we're just talking about, well, each side has to be willing to listen to the other side because perhaps you agree on more than you think, right? But even beyond that scenario, if you want to be a good communicator and a good rhetorician, you have to, I repeat, you have to listen to people you agree with as well as people you disagree with. Because if you never listen to anyone, then how do you know what you're trying to argue for? In other words, perhaps people already agree with you and you don't realize that. Perhaps you can change their minds by listening because now you can show them where you agree on certain things. So listening is a huge part of communication and rhetoric.
Yeah, you write in the book that it's important to stay not just self-righteous but self-critical.
Oh, yes, yes, big time.
Can you give some examples of that?
Well, in terms of my own experience with activism, organizing, and radicalism, you know, every activist is self-righteous. If you didn't believe in the righteousness of your cause, you wouldn't be out in the streets doing what you do. But at the same time, though, you have to be self-critical, self-reflective. As Socrates once said, the unexamined life is not worth living. In other words, we have to sit down, we have to examine not simply the world around us, but ourselves, analyze and reflect upon our own inner desires, our own political wants and needs. And as we do that, hopefully we come to a better understanding of what we're doing. Because realize that as human beings, we're all fallible, right? In other words, we're all going to make mistakes. And just like we look back 20, 30, 50 years ago and say, well, yes, I agree with that protest movement. However, they were sexist. However, they were racist. We'll realize that 100 years from now, people will also look back at us and say, well, I agree with them. However, they were, and fill in the blank, whatever that may be. So realize that you have to buttress your self-righteousness with your own self-critical examination.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Jason Delgandio is my guest. His new book is called Rhetoric for Radicals, a Handbook for 21st Century Activists. Let's go next to Segoville and speak with Ray. Hi, Ray.
Hello, and Chris.
Hey.
Great show.
Thank you.
I just got one question. You know, why can't we organize people and get, you know, when we were young, everybody was out in the streets, you know, and the stuff that Bush has pulled, and I'm saying just because I think he pulled some stuff. But why aren't the kids out in the street and the people aren't out in the street protesting all of this? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
That's a common question. It is a very common question. I think it's a good question. Many people want to ask why, for instance, back in the late 60s and early 70s, everyone seemed to be protesting. But nowadays, considering all that's happened in recent times, there's actually very few people, quote-unquote, out in the streets. And first I want to say that's actually not necessarily true. There are plenty of organizations, plenty of groups doing lots of great work. There really are people out there embodying, quote-unquote, radicalism. But at the same time, they'll realize that we live in a different time, right? If you look back over the last 20 to 30 years, we had 8 years of the Reagan administration, 4 years of Bush Sr., 8 years of Clinton, and 8 years of Bush Jr. And through that time period, people have become very complacent. In other words, they have become complacent with the idea of other people suffering, right? In other words, it's become more about individualism, more about personal consumption, more about my personal lifestyle, as opposed to, you know, social structures, as opposed to, you know, people in other countries that are suffering, right? And there are a million reasons as to why that is, and I can't give you a 30-second answer. But there are simply different social conditions that exist today than there did 30 years ago. So it's not simply that Americans don't want to get out there, but it's more of an overall social and cultural issue that we have to address.
I wonder, too, about the extent to which the public square has really moved online so mm-hmm. that people can take part in these big movements without necessarily being physically present somewhere.
No, I think that's a large part of it, yes. So much, much, much of activism actually occurs online now. And I think that's a great thing. I cannot imagine a social movement existing today that didn't use blogs, emails, websites, all different aspects of YouTube, so on and so on and so on. I think it's a huge part of activism. At the same time, though, I don't think that, for lack of better words, technological activism can replace, you know, person-to-person, face-to-face activism. I do think we need more people on the streets speaking with people one-on-one, because I think that's really where you build the human connection, the one-on-one connection that really mobilizes people to stand up for their rights.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Brad in Rockwall. Hello, Brad.
Hey, what's going on?
How you doing?
We're good.
Hey, what makes you the expert on all this stuff? That's my question, one of them.
Well, I'm not...
We'll give Jason a chance to answer that. Go ahead, Jason.
I don't necessarily consider myself a quote-unquote expert. However, I do have experience with activism. I've worked with globalization issues, issues of free trade and fair trade, anti-war campaigns, Latin American solidarity campaigns, and so on, as well as receiving my PhD from a department called speech communication. So I specialize in how human beings communicate with each other. And so what I'm doing in the book is actually combining those two things. In other words, combining my activist experience with my knowledge of communication and rhetoric.
Working, as I imagine you do, with a lot of undergrads, I wonder if you can characterize sort of the intersection between passion that these young people have about the things they care about mm-hmm. and then their ability to actually do something about that and communicate effectively about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a large part of why I wrote the book. I think that many people, not just radicals, but many people in general, are very passionate about politics, are very passionate about society or social issues, and they're also very committed to those issues. But they're not always great at communicating that passion and commitment in effective ways, Right? And I think that's the key word there, effective. In other words, how can you maximize your effectiveness in the public arena? And it really does come down to communication. You have to hone in your skills. Now, like I said earlier, as human beings, we're always communicating. However, that does not mean that we're all equally effective at communicating. Right? So it's the difference that it's not that we just communicate, but as an activist, as someone who's politically involved, you want to sharpen and craft your skills to maximize your effectiveness in the public arena. And that's the whole point of the book.
One thing that comes across is that it's very important to boil the message down to its essence when you're communicating for the first time to other people outside of your group. What does it take to boil those messages down so that we know that the most important elements are being held onto and other things are set aside?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a few things. One, in terms of your message, can you crystallize your message into one clear sentence that the average person can understand? Again, one clear sentence that the average person can understand, right? But then two, again, who is your audience? Who are you actually trying to communicate that message to, right? And number three, you want to craft and adapt that message to a particular audience. So your message, your audience, and then adapting your message to that audience. And you want to get those three things focused. And once you do that, right, you will become a better communicator and be able to crystallize your message in a way that can affect different people across a different spectrum of socioeconomic class, culture, race, etc.
And how do slogans and catchphrases play into all this?
Oh, well, slogans, catchphrases, sound bites, all that's very important. I mean, you think about the media landscape of today's society, you have to have your slogan, you have to have your sound bite, so on and so on and so on. But when you do that, though, you want to sit down and really think about your message. In other words, you know, what kind of slogan will catch the passerby? That's what you want to ask yourself, right? And it should be crisp, it should be clean, it should be catchy, right? And it's almost, you want to make it jump off the page, if, you know, if you use that, it's kind of a bad metaphor here, but you want to jump off and kind of pop out. That way when people, they hear it or they see it, it stays with them, right? And then later on when they get home, they can go on the internet, look it up, so on and so on and so on.
Let's go next to Michael in Bedford. Hello, Michael.
Hi. Yes, I was curious. It kind of dovetails on the question about protests in the 60s, and I was curious if I've heard protesters recently say that, you know, they felt like the mainstream media was, just by its very structure, was kind of set up to portray them in a negative light. And also, I was wondering if just the kind of the vast array of causes that we have now, like through the internet, just there's just so many to choose from that nothing really reaches a critical mass that it maybe did in the 60s.
Thanks for your call.
Well, going in reverse, I think that last point, it's interesting. I don't think I've thought about it like that before, but I do think there's legitimacy to that idea. In other words, we have so many outlets in terms of the internet, right, that you have, rather than let's say you had five outlets, so everyone's going to go to one of those five outlets, but now you have 500 or 5,000 outlets, so then people are broadening out their spectrum of sources. So that is a possible way of why we don't have, quote-unquote, critical mass, perhaps. I'm not sure, but perhaps. In terms of the first question he asked, I do think that the mainstream mass media nowadays, the overall structure, it's very hard to work within that structure if you're an activist looking to change the world or to create a different world. And I say that because much of mainstream media nowadays is concerned with celebrity gossip, right? It is so quick in terms of the sound bites, right? You have a guest on there for maybe 90 seconds, and the question becomes, well, how much information can you actually reveal in 90-second clips, right? And it's very difficult to display or, introduce alternative ideas, alternative politics in such a structure because you really can't say enough to get people involved into your politics.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Gabriel who answers the question, why no protests? He says, no draft. We don't have the social safety net and parents who can afford to support us if we lose our jobs. We don't have the limitless job market that existed in the 1960s. And he says, we saw that none of the hippie protests accomplished anything. They didn't end the Vietnam War. They didn't get equal pay for women. Schools are worse now and more segregated than they were then. Certainly a more negative look at the impact of demonstrations. What do you think about that, Jason?
I don't agree entirely with the negative approach to it. I mean, I think there is some legitimacy to what that individual is saying. But for instance, the quote-unquote hippies, first of all, let's realize that everyone in the streets wasn't necessarily hippie or didn't necessarily identify as a hippie. Also realize that people who did identify as hippie, their only concern was not simply the war, but a overall cultural resistance, right? So the fact that you had long hair, that you wore beads, that you wore bell-bottoms, was actually a statement against the whole cultural edifice of America, so it wasn't simply against the war. Now, in terms of stopping the war, if it wasn't for the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people out in the streets, you know, that war would have continued even longer. So I do think that had an impact. In terms of equal pay for women, no, we are still fighting that fight today. There's no doubt about that. But if it wasn't for the women's movement in the 1970s, if it wasn't for second wave feminism, we would be even further back than we are today, right? So it's not about one grand clash that's going to change everything. Instead, it's a long historical process, and each person, each group, each generation has to make its contribution in any way it can. And I do believe that the era of 60s and 70s protest movements did make a contribution. Now the question becomes, how can this current generation also build upon that contribution and make a greater contribution?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next to Wosu in Grand Prairie. Hi, Wosu.
Yes, hi, Chris. How are you today?
Great, thank you.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, my question is, if radicalism is defined as negative connotation, do one have to be radical before achieving his goal? Or a group of people, a movement, do they have to be radical before achieving the objectives? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, in terms of do you have to be radical in order to make a change, to accomplish your goal? And again, I think that's how you as an individual as well as your movement, how it wants to define itself. You don't have to define yourself as radical, right? Again, like I said earlier, the word radical in all words, in all language, they're all relational and relative, and I mean that in a positive sense, right? So if you have a social movement that is fighting, let's say, for better health care, well, you know, some people may perceive that as being radical. Other people say, no, it's not radical. It's actually very mainstream. I would say the very, very large majority of Americans want better health care. Right? If that's the case, the question becomes, is that radical or is that mainstream? And again, these are all relative terms that each individual as well as each movement has to define for itself.
We'll return to our conversation with Jason Delgandio in just a minute. His new book is called Rhetoric for Radicals, a handbook for 21st century activists. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jason Delgandio. His new book is called Rhetoric for Radicals. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We have an email here from David who says, Noam Chomsky is a linguist and a social activist, but he never links the two. Do you think there is an inherent link between those two interests?
Well, yes and no. I'm very familiar with Noam Chomsky's work, and much more so with his political work rather than linguist work. I do think there's a link. For me personally, there is definitely a language between language and politics in the sense that the language that we use, right, shapes our perception of the world. And that perception of the world, though, is actually the reality that we embody and live out, right? So if you change your language, then you're going to change how people think. If you change how people think, you're going to change their orientation to the world. And once you've done all of those things, you've just set the conditions for the possibility of social change. So I do think there is a direct link between language and politics, yes.
Let's go next to Courtney in Austin. Hey, Courtney.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
So I just had a quick question. I was wondering what your opinion was about Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart and their kind of humorous appeal and, like, their rhetoric strategy towards, like, politics and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call.
Yes, I think both. I've watched both of those shows on a regular basis, no doubt about that. I think they're hilarious. I think they provide some of the best commentary, political commentary, in the mainstream media. Now, when I say that, though, also take that with a grain of salt. And I say that because what they're doing is satire. They're doing political humor, political satire, which I think is very important. And I do think there are shows that are worth watching, right? And I think we can get a lot of stuff out of that. And I think they often reveal in very humorous ways how some media outlets actually function. I think that's a good thing. It brings those things to attention. At the same time, though, again, we shouldn't reduce our political lives to such shows that use political satire. I think those are two different things. Appreciate it, enjoy it, get what you can, and I think there's a lot there. But realize, though, that should not be the totality of our political living.
Would you characterize either one of those programs as radical elements?
That's a good question. Again, I mean, for me personally, I would say they're not necessarily radical, right? But they do a great job of getting us to reflect upon politics as well as mainstream media outlets. But again, though, I could see someone else arguing very differently, and I would accept that argument. So again, it's a relational issue we're talking about here.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll speak next with Sergio in Fort Worth. Hey, Sergio.
Oh, greetings. Thank you very much, Jason, for addressing in my book one of the most crucial points that we have any place, that our inability to communicate. I have a question that I consider practical. Mm-hmm. The politics is beautiful, but in many instances, it's totally an inaccessible environment for all of us. Mm-hmm. But on a practical basis, I am very puzzled of the fact that in every one of our hospitals and all over the country, we use stethoscopes 25 million times a day. Mm-hmm. And in spite of multiple attempts to communicate that to the physicians and to every organization, that those instruments are contaminated and that there is already an accessible, disposable diaphragm for those stethoscopes, no change has been made. How does one communicate such a very important and practical problem that is costing the nation billions of dollars a year? I will close and I'll listen to your comment, and I am very grateful again. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Okay, so a real-life example there, Jason. Any immediate thoughts?
Well, a couple of immediate thoughts. One, you know, what is your evidence for that claim? Right? I'm not disputing that claim at all. I'm really not. I don't doubt that it's true, actually. I'm not disputing it at all. But one, do you have concrete evidence of what you are saying? Right? In other words, you made an assertion. You're trying to create an argument. So you made your assertion. Now, how are you going to back up that assertion? Where's your evidence? Right? That's number one. Number two, who has the ability to implement the changes you are asking for, right? So some people you can talk to and say, yeah, I agree with that, but I can't do anything about it. So you have to figure out exactly who has the power to enact those changes, right? So that's number two. And number three, now how can you, you know, get a sit-down meeting with that individual? How can you get that person to literally listen to your message, right? And those are three things. In other words, how do you back up your assertion that you just made? Then two, figure out who has the ability or the power to enact those changes. And three, how can you get the person to actually listen to your argument? Now, beyond that, well, sometimes, you know, you can't. Sometimes you do meet a wall, and power is not willing to concede. And that's unfortunate. That's the world that we live in. But if you can do those first two things I said, perhaps you'll see the changes you want to see.
So I wonder if that reflects how you choose your target audience. Ideally, maybe at first it would be the AMA or some other organization that sets up guidelines. And if the AMA or whatever other organization wouldn't listen and wouldn't respond, then do you go to the broader audience and you try to appeal to patients who worry about being infected by dirty stethoscopes?
Oh, yes. I think that's, now we're talking about mobilizing communities, mobilizing people, creating demonstrations, creating a social movement, yes. I mean, so I guess I was thinking in the direct confrontation here. But yeah, if that individual or that organization or that institution is not willing to listen to you, that's when you need to go out and widen your audience and garner a kind of a base support and say, look, you know, look at all these voices. If you don't listen to our demands, then this movement is going to get bigger and bigger, and now you're going to have a problem on your hands.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Janet in Cleburne. Hey, Janet.
Yes.
Hi, go ahead, please.
I have advocated with some groups that took what some say are some rather extreme measures, such as chaining themselves to doors in order to get their point heard. Some people in the community say those measures are too extreme. I happen to disagree. I'd like to get your opinion on that.
Yes, well, the phraseology that I often use or I'm familiar with in my own activism is that, in other words, you are taking direct action, right? A more popular term might be nonviolent civil disobedience, right? So to disobey the laws of civil society because civil society is acting unjustly, right? Now, in terms of some individuals saying, well, those are too extreme, perhaps they are, but I think you have to make the case as to why they are not. In other words, one thing you'd say is that I'm enacting an alternative form of politics or an alternative form of public discourse, right? So, for instance, we don't all have the ability to sit down with our representatives and have rational discussions, right? However, we do have the ability to take more direct actions into doing building occupations, locking ourselves in doorways, so on and so on and so on. Now, recognize the risk of, though, when you do that, you have personal risk of being arrested, being hurt, so on and so on and so on. You also have the risk of being smeared in the media or even smeared by people you know in the community. So that's a very big risk. Now, the way you combat that discursive risk is to be prepared to explain why you use the tactics that you did. If you can make that explanation and convince people of why you use it, why you use those tactics were a good reason, well, then you minimize your risk in terms of discourse.
Our email address is think@kera.org. We have an email from Bill in Dallas who says, I worked with a guy who was old enough to have been at Haight-Ashbury and in the Vietnam War protests. He cautioned me not to idealize the 1960s. He said it was a very hateful time, especially between political and generational groups. I'm wondering if you think, Jason, that we are actually more effective today in the way we handle rhetoric than the much, I suppose, the obvious time that people go to in their minds when they think about the history of American protests.
Well, I'm hesitant to say that one generation is more or less effective, right? Because I think you could argue either way, right, for different reasons. But I do think, though, that many of today's activists have learned from previous time periods, previous generations, right? And so perhaps what we're seeing today is people that are involved in politics, are involved in activism, they sat down, they have learned from previous generations and built upon their rhetorical strategies. Right? I would frame it in that way.
Mm-hmm. Are there things that we learned from the great labor protests that maybe we didn't pay as much attention to in the 1960s that are sort of coming back into vogue now as rhetorical strategies?
Yes, in terms of the labor struggles of the early 20th century. One, you know, this has come up in a few workshops that I've done. People have asked about the old soapboxes, right? And if you think about it, during the labor struggles, there was more public speaking going on. There was people standing on street corners with groups of individuals using soapboxes. I'm not necessarily saying that is a good strategy today, right? But I do think we can learn from the oratory of that time period. And I say that because today's activists, like we said earlier, are very much engaged in internet activism, and I think that's effective, but I don't think that will ever replace good public speaking skills, good writing skills. So I think we should go back to previous time periods, previous generations, like the labor struggles, and learn about how they performed their oration, how they performed their speeches, and then adapt those to today's current conditions. And if we do that, I think, again, we're building upon previous generations. I think that's very helpful.
Let's hear next from Ronnie in Fort Worth. Hey, Ronnie.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. I guess my question is, what's the standard for being a radical? I've seen things where where people say the government's radical, and I've seen where the government says, well, these people are radical, and people go to jail for it, and all this kind of stuff. And I'm just wondering, what's the standard? Is it a generational thing, or is it, what is it? What causes people, the big difference between everybody? And thanks for taking my call, and I'll listen to your answer off the phone.
Thanks very much.
Bye.
Sounds like you could write a whole other book, Jason, about the definition of radicalism.
Again, I don't think there is one standard we can set. Like I said at the very beginning, I do think radicalism, though, is about going to the root problem or problems or root causes of a social problem, right? Going to that root cause and then really trying to overturn that root problem and then to create an alternative world. Now, again, though, I watch the media, I watch the news, I read the papers. Some people do say, well, the government's radical, we need to get rid of all the government, or Barack Obama's a radical and he shouldn't be in office, so on and so on and so on. So again, this is going to be relational or relative to your perception and understanding of what radicalism is. However, I don't think it's just all up in the air and anything goes, right? I don't believe that. So in other words, I don't think Barack Obama is a radical. I really don't. I don't think Michelle Obama is a radical, right? I don't think Bill Clinton was a radical, right? Perhaps they are liberal. They're probably more of being centrist than anything else, right? Radicalism, though, is really about how can I put this? Radicalism is about envisioning a better world and then taking active steps in your daily personal life to achieve that alternative world. In other words, what is your vision of a better world? And now start walking towards that and pushing yourself in your personal life, to put yourself out there, to take a little bit more risk today, a little bit more tomorrow, with the hopes of one day actually achieving that alternative world that you envision.
An email question asks about the extent to which you drew on Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals as a basis for the book.
Oh, well, the title comes right from that. There's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. So Saul Alinsky's famous book is called Rules for Radicals. And I'm very familiar with that work, very familiar with him as an activist, as an author. And I just appropriated that phrase as rhetoric for radicals. Right? So rather than simply having rules for radicals, in other words, what we should do in our organizing, I say, okay, there are also rules or guidelines for our communication and our rhetoric, and if we embody those rules or guidelines, we'll become better activists and improve our ability to change the social world.
Who, Jason, do you think is doing radicalism really effectively in today's world?
That's a good question. That's a good question. I've been asked that many times, and I don't think we're living in a generation or living in a time period where we're going to see a Dr. King, for instance, right? And I say that because many people think of Dr. King as, you know, the epitome of effective radicalism, effective oration, so on and so on and so on. I would agree. He was great. There's no doubt about that. But we're living in a, quote-unquote, decenter world. In other words, we're not going to have one movement or one leader or one, quote-unquote, vanguard party that's going to lead us to profound social change. Instead, it's really about each individual improving his or her communication skills, living in one's own community, infecting change that way. Right? And then if we're all doing that, then we're all taking necessary steps to improve our public discourse, to improve our social world, so on and so on and so on.
Do you think there are people clamoring for sort of a centralized sort of radicalism like we saw with Dr. King?
Well, yeah, yes, I do. I mean, I've gone to meetings, gone to organizations, and many people will say, well, you know, we need another Dr. King or things like that. But then many other people are saying what I'm saying in the sense that, well, that was effective during that time period, right? But if you think about the Internet, right, the Internet is a vast global network involving a decentered or decentralized structure, right? Now think about, though, how the Internet has literally altered our consciousness. In other words, altered our perception, our thoughts, our knowledges, right? And so I believe that we are actually living in an era of decentered, decentralized networks. And because of that, we have to adapt our activism as well as our communication and rhetoric to those social conditions.
How do you make decisions, Jason, in your personal activism about when to lead and when to follow?
That's a tough choice. I think that's a very tough choice. And I think it really is about listening, right? Listening to the people around you, right? And then as you listen to those people, right, try to feel your way into their thoughts, feel your way into their visions, and then lead by example, right? And so that may mean at times standing up and speaking. Other times it may mean sitting down and listening. Other times maybe mean marching in tandem with everyone else. And I think if you can gauge yourself that way, I think then you're actually becoming a better leader. Because if you stand up and say, well, I'm the leader, that can actually be very oppressive. And I think it's more about being a good community member, a good partner in terms of enacting with other people the world that you want to see.
Yeah, I guess it has to start with getting along with the people that you're working with to begin
with. Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Jason Delgandio is an activist himself. He's also an assistant professor at Temple University. His newly published book is called Rhetoric for Radicals, a Handbook for 21st Century Activists. Jason, it's been a really interesting discussion. I so appreciate you spending the hour with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it myself.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.